With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Agriculture and business coalitions oppose water rights bills. That's coming up in a California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News report. Critics of California's water rights systems are seeking to overhaul rules that date back to California's founding in 1850. Three water rights bills are pending in the California legislature that would expand the authority of the California State Water Resources Control Board. These bills are opposed by a large coalition that includes dozens of farm groups, water agencies, and business groups. Christopher Anderson of the Association of California Water Agencies said the bills, quote, present a foundational change for California water rights systems. Again, that was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report. And now let's get into today's show headlines. American Farmland Trust applauds the No Emits Act. Representatives from Wisconsin and California introduced the Naturally Offsetting Emissions by Managing and Implementing Tillage Strategies, also known as the No Emits Act. The bill would help support farmers in improving soil health. American Farmland Trust applauded the bipartisan bill's introduction and its inclusion of one of AFT's top bill priorities, which is establishing a federal match for state and tribal soil health programs. Tim Fink, AFT's policy director, says, quote, in recent years, states have begun creating innovative soil health programs that fill current gaps in support and help producers voluntarily adopt soil health practices in locally tailored ways. Adding, quote, state programs can struggle to keep pace with producer demand, so creating a federal program to match state and tribal funding would help leverage existing soil health programs and incentivize others to create programs of their own. Creating that federal match program has broad support from AFT, six state agencies, and stakeholders from 29 states. NAFB contributed to that report. And now here's Brian German with more agriculture news.
Multiple bills are moving through the California legislature which have the potential to upend the current water rights system. President and CEO of Western Growers, Dave Puglia, said that the legislation could threaten necessary investments in water infrastructure.
Losing the certainty that they've relied upon for decades under the current system, you would see a total and complete slowdown or even stoppage of investment in water infrastructure, I think. It's very hard for water users who are expected to cost share with federal or state governments on water infrastructure projects. Very hard to see those private interests writing those checks when they have no guarantee that there'll be a return on the investment because the water rights that they relied on historically have been upended. So I think there's just danger in this discussion. And I think it's one that sort of one of those times when you ask yourself, is this a problem that demands a solution or is this a solution searching for a problem? And I think it's the latter.
$4.1 million in grant funding has been awarded for climate smart dairy and livestock research projects through the California Department of Food and Agriculture. Three projects have been awarded funding support as part of the California Livestock Methane Measurement, Mitigation, and Thriving Environments Research Grant Program. CDFA has awarded $1.6 million to Bubbleology Research International for a project to verify the greenhouse gas and environmental co-benefits of climate-smart ag practices on California dairies. Muteric LLC has been awarded $500,000 for a project to conduct on-farm feeding trials to verify the methane-mitigating benefits of seaweed-based feed additives within the regular feed rations of Central Valley dairy cows. Finally, $2 million has been awarded to a project to demonstrate efficient recycling of manure effluents into valuable agricultural inputs. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Why do you listen?
You get the local news and the weather is up to date all the time.
Oh, I love sports. It's good to hear what's going on because you can't make it to all the games.
I listen from 8 o'clock in the morning to 6 o'clock at night.
It moves with me. It's portable. It goes with me. It's in my car. I can find my mood. I can flip through stations up and down the dial. There's always something that's talking to me.
Why do you listen? Go to whyilisten.com. Tell us why you listen, and you have a chance to win $500. Visit whyilisten.com today.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, the House Agriculture Committee held a hearing Wednesday on the digital divide in rural America. Ranking Member David Scott of Georgia asked if USDA was the right agency to handle the issue of rural broadband. The first response was from Jim Matheson, Chief Executive Officer of the National Rural Electric Cooperative Association.
To expand on what I previously said about the value of the Department of Agriculture perspective, they know rural America. They prioritize issues that matter to rural America in their broadband funding. In terms of rurality or low population density, that's one of their criteria they look at. Look, this is important for these rural areas. Let's put this out there. Internet service matters. Affordability matters. America's electric cooperatives serve 92% of the persistent poverty counties in America. So investments in broadband for these counties that have persistent poverty, it's an opportunity for economic development that means something in terms of looking forward in the future. I think the Department of Agriculture has the right perspective to do this. Look, there's a lot of other money, as you mentioned, Mr. Scott, in terms of the programs. I get that. And we're going to pursue all those opportunities, but we're glad RUS has an important role.
Next, Shirley Bloomfield, Chief Executive Officer of the NTCA, the Rural Broadband Association.
Thank you very much. So I think that USDA understands rural America like nobody else, you know, no other federal agency understands the needs on the ground and how important connectivity is for rural Americans who, frankly, suffer from the handicap of distance, whether it's to education, medical services, whether it's tools for precision ag. So there is no other agency that is more in tune to what rural America actually needs. But that is one of the reasons why I think they've taken a leadership role and, frankly, set a higher standard for service than other agencies and any of these other programs have, in part because they know that rural Americans actually really do need these services. We saw during the pandemic how people used internet and broadband for all of the different reasons that they did. But I still see, I look at companies like Pineland Telephone Cooperative down in Georgia, that frankly today all of their customers have symmetrical speeds because they know that that is the way people can utilize getting to market, doing the services they need, and frankly do, you know, make sure that we continue economic development. So USDA has been primarily focused on really how to best serve rural America. So I think they are a very critical player.
Also on the panel, Tom Stroop, president of the Satellite Industry Association.
Unlike most of the other representatives here, our infrastructure is deployed in space, and so there's no further cost associated with covering rural America. The service that you get is comparable between cities, between rural America. So really the additional funding would be made available for access to Earth stations, to consumer equipment, but I definitely feel that USDA has an important role to play. I would also like to emphasize the point that Mr. Zumwalt made previously, which is the need for coordination between the other funding organizations.
In other news, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced a $262.5 million investment in institutions of higher education to foster the next generation of diverse agricultural professionals across the nation. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says the investment will provide training and support to more than 20,000 future food and agricultural leaders through 33 project partners.
Now, these investments will cover 24 states and territories. So it's broad-reaching, it's extensive. And what's most exciting about this is the possibility of how many young people can be impacted and affected by this decision.
Four projects were announced in California, including California State Polytechnic University, California State University of Monterey Bay, Hartnell Community College in Salinas, San Diego State University, and University of California, Santa Cruz. That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, with a massive population exceeding 270 million and a livestock sector that is being hampered by animal health concerns, Indonesia is a country that presents significant growth opportunities for the U.S. beef and pork industries. With more on that story, here's John Harris.
With a huge consumer base and animal health issues challenging its domestic livestock production, Indonesia represents significant growth opportunities for U.S. red meat exports. Arofi Satrio Alam, the U.S. Meat Export Federation's new representative in Indonesia, has more details.
The rising middle class population They have extra purchasing power. And U.S. beef perceived as a high-quality product, which the young generation now want to experience. And also, since 2022, Indonesia is battling with FMD and lumpy skin disease. So many cattle are slaughtered early. Indonesia tried to stabilize the price by importing Indian buffalo meat and also beef from Brazil. But so far, the effort is not successful. The demand is for good quality beef, which Indian buffalo meat and Brazilian beef cannot fulfill. It is fulfilled by U.S. and also Australian, especially for chef, food service, and high-end retailers.
While consumed by a minority of Indonesia's population, there are also opportunities for U.S. pork.
So this is quite underestimated, I think, because the strength of this country is its massive population. So 10% of the Indonesian population is non-Muslim, and those 10% represent 27 million people. And even though the consumption is not huge, the potential is there for pork, for both retail and food service, mostly high-end. And African swine fever, starting in the north of Indonesia and spreading all over the place right now, it's affecting the local supply. But it is not hindered the consumption rate of the Indonesian people. That 27 million people try to find substitution for the product. So currently, there are a huge increase of imported European pork, showing that demand for good quality meat, pork or beef, is there.
Promotional activities in Indonesia are funded by USDA, the Beef Checkoff Program, and the National Pork Board. For more information, please visit usmef.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
Thanks, John. USDA's Foreign Ag Service recently announced the American Sheep Industry Association is among recipients of the fiscal year 2023 Quality Samples Program funding. USP is instrumental helping foreign customers learn about and try American wool. The program has helped develop long-term customers who have purchased millions of pounds of American wool, but QSP is just one of several FAS programs through which ASI receives annual funding. The Market Access Program, otherwise known as MAP, and the Foreign Market Development Program also contribute funds to ASI's wool marketing efforts each year. The MAP program shares the cost of overseas marketing and promotional activities, while the FMD program focuses on trade servicing and trade capacity building. Learn more on their website, sheepusa.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them, just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A chance for firsthand knowledge of ag business in Chile. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. The U.S. Foreign Agricultural Service is accepting applications from U.S. exporters for a trade mission to Santiago, Chile, September 25th through the 29th. American agribusinesses will participate in business-to-business meetings with potential importers from both Chile and Peru. The trade mission coincides with Peru's USDA-endorsed food trade show that offers additional networking opportunities for participants. FAS Administrator Daniel Whitney says this year they are celebrating the 200th anniversary of the U.S.-Chile diplomatic relations. Chile and the neighboring Peru are some of our key trading partners, he says, representing the second and third largest markets in South America. Total agricultural exports to these markets have grown significantly since establishing the Chile Free Trade Agreement and the Peru Trade Promotions Agreement. Exports to this region exceeded $2 billion in 2022. The region features relatively high per capita incomes and purchasing power. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCohen. The Supreme Court has issued a ruling that makes it easier for employers to sue labor unions for damages caused by a work stoppage. The court's opinion has implications for ag employers. In a recent decision, the U.S. Supreme Court said that an employer can sidestep federal administrative agency procedures and go straight to court when striking workers damage the company's property rather than merely cause economic harm. The case involved a concrete company that sued the labor union representing its drivers for damages. The workers filled mixer trucks with concrete ready to pour, knowing they were going to walk away. The company sued for damage to their property, something that's not protected under federal labor law. The union claimed that the matter had to go through federal administrative channels first. The Supreme Court said the case was more like an ordinary tort lawsuit than a federal labor dispute, so the company could go straight to court. Walking away was inconsistent with accepting a perishable commodity. What's the ag angle? Where there are labor disputes in agriculture, they're often timed to damage perishable food products such as fruit and vegetables. Based on the court's 8-1 opinion, merely timing a work stoppage during harvest might not be enough to be deemed economic damage unless the union has a contract. But striking after a sorting line has begun would seem to be enough. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McOwen.
There is much behind-the-scenes work regarding planning and preparation for USDA-led agricultural trade missions, especially within the host country by both state and agriculture department officials. As example, the June Ag Trade Mission in Japan. Among those coordinating efforts on the ground in Japan were U.S. Minister Counselor for Agricultural Affairs, Morgan Perkins.
We're very fortunate, Ben, to have both an Agricultural Trade Office and an Office of Agricultural Affairs, so we have a lot more personnel on the ground than most countries that are hosting these trade missions, so we kind of divided it up with the groups that are coming.
Perkins and State Department colleagues at the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo handled the pre-mission briefings and itinerary for those considered political members of our nation's Ag Trade Mission delegation. In this case, its lead, Undersecretary for Trade and Foreign Agricultural Affairs Alexis Taylor, State Ag Department Secretaries and Commissioners, and representatives from cooperator groups, such as trade and commodity organizations.
Familiarization briefing, some meetings for Undersecretary Taylor with embassy leadership, so we can make sure that USDA in Washington and the U.S. government in Tokyo are on the same page. Bilateral meetings for her with several ministries in the Japanese government. Briefings for Undersecretary Taylor and all the State Department of Ag reps on the mission of the Ministry of Agriculture in Japan, how they're confronting the challenges faced by the Japanese agricultural sector and preparing for the future, including combating climate change.
The director of USDA's Ag Trade Office in Japan, Chanda Burke, and her team were involved in facilitating the itinerary for representatives from commodity groups and food and ag production businesses looking to sell or expand sale of products in the Japanese marketplace.
We're going to be taking them on a tour of two different retail locations, and we have a fantastic plenary panel planned that's going to do a deeper dive into consumer trends, the restaurant sector, touch a little bit on Japan's well-developed food processing sector, and then we're also recruiting Japanese buyers for B2B meetings in two cities, in both Tokyo and Osaka. So we're really excited to help our U.S. companies make new connections, deepen existing connections, and hopefully record some sales in the months and years following this ATM.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
We want everyone to breathe clean, healthy air, but California's traffic and mountains don't make it easy. Our mountains trap pollution, making us more vulnerable to dirty air. Today's farmers are voluntarily doing their part with help from USDA's Natural Resources Conservation Service. How? By replacing older diesel-powered tractors and equipment, treating dusty farm roads, avoiding open burning, and more. Can't afford it? NRCS has invested $178 million helping California farmers clean our air. They can help you too. NRCS, helping people help the land since 1935.
Welcome back to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
Psychology in the grain trade is back to where it was a year ago, worried about record low carryovers. I'm Mark Oppold with your Bottom Line Report this Thursday, brought to you by Superior Livestock. Bottom Line grain analysts suggest the current market closely resembles that of a year ago, when there was uncertainty regarding record or near record low carryover numbers. Traders felt good enough about the 23 crop. Sellers pushed the price to multi-year lows just 30 days ago. Now, 30 days later, Mother Nature has the market back to highs from late last fall. No rain coming, we would suggest that December corn could retest at 680 level from late April a year ago. November soybeans challenging 1448 from a number of the same time April a year ago. This is the Bottom Line Report. We see May cattle placements on tomorrow's Cattle on Feed report up 1.5%, maybe 2%, first time an increase in nearly a year. More selling pressure into July. Iowa-Minnesota average hog weights, 278.5 pounds. That is 5 pounds below the 5-year average for late June. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
The countdown is on, but will lawmakers beat the clock on crafting a new farm bill? The farm bill clock is ticking, with little signs yet of progress toward writing a new law by the September 30th expiration of the existing farm bill. There's no text yet on the Senate side, and a cautious commitment by House Ag Chair G.T. Thompson to draft a bill before the August recess.
We have three options for the upcoming farm bill. Let it expire, pass an extension, or craft a bill that works for all farmers, ranchers, producers, and foresters nationwide. Of course, this is predicated on bipartisanship and the will of the House and Senate,
which has been tainted by the latest House GOP push to achieve deeper spending cuts through annual spending bills than the president agreed to. The recent GOP White House debt limit budget deal left little, if any, room for new farm bill spending. Iowa Senator Chuck Grassley says the concern is mounting.
I'm increasingly concerned that we're going to fall behind.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for AgNet West.
This is how hemorrhagic bowel syndrome can affect your herd and drain profits. Dairy producers can take action to support their dairy cows' immune systems to better withstand exposure to the mold believed to cause HBS. Dr. Scott Bascom, Executive Technical Services Manager for Dairy with Phibro Animal Health, talks about what producers need to know about HBS.
HBS is an intestinal syndrome, and its trademark symptom is causing sudden death in dairy cattle. And it's sporadic. Most often occurs in high-producing dairy cows, but it can occur in lower producing dairy cows or dry cows. But it's particularly troubling because often one day a cow looks quite healthy and normal and productive, and then the next day the producer finds her dead in the barn. And if they do an autopsy, they find a massive blood clot in her gut that would indicate it would be hemorrhagic bowel syndrome.
He talks about what producers should watch for.
They need to keep an eye on their forage quality, try to minimize the amount of mold that's fed to the cows. They also need to do the best they can to minimize stress on the cows. We believe it's caused by a mold, and it's a mycotic infection, meaning that the animal is exposed to the mold, and that mold goes inside their body, inside their tissues, and begins to grow and cause damage.
Bascom talks about how feeding Omnigen nutritional specialty product helps prepare cows to combat mycosis to help reduce the risk of HBS.
We work with a hypothesis that HBS occurs in cows that have a suppressed immune system that are then exposed to Aspergillus fumigatus. So Omnigen was created specifically to help prevent HBS. Scientists that created this product were looking for a product to reduce the growth of mold or fungus in the feed and also support the cow's immune system to promote a healthy immune system. So it's that two-prong approach with Omnigen that helps prevent HBS. The proprietary ingredients in Omnigen have been shown in research studies to support a healthy immune system. And then there's some antifungal properties of Omnigen as well that can reduce the growth of mold in the feed. Dairies should work to minimize stressors much as they can, for example, heat stress, overcrowding of cattle. feeding Omnigen to cows helps maintain a healthy immune system that may help them address diseases or syndromes like HBS.
He talks about where to find more information.
They could contact their local fiber representative. Anybody who works for Fibro in the dairy part of our business has a lot of information. Or they could visit a website called theomnigendifference.com. Or they could download a free webinar titled Dairy's Most Profit Draining Challenges, Hemorrhagic Bowel Syndrome, which is on the Fibro Academy website at academy.phc.com.
Again, that's Dr. Scott Bascom of Fibro Animal Health. Chad Smith reporting.
It was back in February when USDA asked farmers how much of what crops they intended to plant this spring. USDA published those planting intentions on the last day of March.
Now here in June, we've got the first opportunity to really measure what farmers actually planted for the season.
And USDA will publish that information in just a few days. Lance Honig with USDA's National Ag Statistics Service says they are right now wrapping up the process of collecting that information and from several sources.
We do utilize a number of different data sources, although the survey work that we do directly with farmers is integral to this.
And so in that regard, for this report,
we reach out to about 60, a little over 60,000 producers, asking them to report the various crops they're growing this year. How many acres did you plant? How many acres do you expect to harvest this year?
But many more farmers are being contacted as experts go out and actually take a look at field segments as part of what is called the June Area Survey.
We're actually sampling about 9,000 segments of land across the country, and we send enumerators out to those segments, make contacts there, try to contact everyone who operates land within the boundaries of those segments. And these segments, that I use that term, they're roughly a square mile in size. They're going to vary based on the land topography and things of that nature. But again, asking very similar questions, finding out what are you growing this season.
But as they say on TV, wait, there's more.
We do look at some satellite imagery. Now, there are certain parts of the country that this year in particular that might be more helpful than others because planting was pretty early in a lot of places, and therefore those crops were likely to be up and growing and easier to identify from a satellite.
And finally, mainly for winter wheat, there is planted acreage information from the Farm Service Agency available. So as we speak, analysts are taking all of this data, working their mathematical magic on it, and they will issue a much-anticipated comprehensive report on planted acreage in just a few days, June 30th, noon Eastern Time. Gary Crawford for the U.S. Department of Agriculture.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Many crops depend on healthy pollinators. From beetles to flies, hummingbirds, bats, and bees, pollinators are essential in helping turn pollen into food. June 19th through 25th is National Pollinator Week, reminding us of the key role pollinators play in preserving natural habitats and producing successful crops. This message is brought to you by Syngenta, committed to protecting the safety and health of pollinators that feed and fuel the world.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Daniel Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
In today's Almond Update from the Almond Board of California, President and CEO of the Central California Almond Growers Association, Michael Kelly, joined the Almond Journey podcast to share some of his thoughts on the current state of the almond industry with Almond Journey podcast host Tim Hammerich.
With four shellers in two different locations, both Kerman and Sanger, the association is the largest wholer sheller of almonds in the world. Michael shares several insights in this episode about the current state of the almond industry, ranging from economics to logistics to technology to supply chain to drivers of past, present, and future success. Michael was hired into this role in 2005, so he's been on the job for about 18 years now. And before that, he held a series of leadership positions in the cotton industry. We begin our conversation by talking about his journey to almonds.
Well, I'm kind of a transplant just like the rest of the almond industry. I grew up in the Imperial Valley. My dad was a cotton, alfalfa, and wheat farmer. And when I was a young man, I started growing cotton and wheat as well. Then when I graduated from the University of Southern California, I always wanted to go back to the Imperial Valley and farm with my dad, but, you know, farm on my own independently. So that was my goal, but cotton was starting to decline. And so I was offered a position working for a cotton company called Producers Cotton Oil Company. I ran cotton gins. And I did that. I trained in Arizona, moved to California, and I moved to several cotton gins here. But cotton started to decline. At the latter part of my cotton career, I was actually working for the National Cotton Board. And I was director of field services in the Western United States. And cotton was on this rapid decline in the West. We went from about 1,350,000 acres of cotton down to, you know, right now there's right at about probably 250,000 acres that's going to be grown in the Western United States. So it was a steep decline. So in 2005, I was looking for another opportunity, and there was a position that was open here as the president and CEO of Central California Almond Growers Association, and I applied. And I went through an extensive interview with a lot of other candidates, and I was fortunate enough to have gotten the job, and that was 18 years ago. So it's been a long ride.
Yeah, and after, you know, everything you've seen in the cotton industry and now everything you've seen over the last 18 years in almonds, is there anything that stands out that you think, you know, the almond industry could or should learn from the cotton industry?
Well, almonds are a little bit different because they don't trade on an open market. So they're highly susceptible to the ups and downs of the growing conditions that are existing in the marketplace. One thing that is really analogous to the cotton industry is the issues with regards to domestic versus foreign trade. Almond industry is so reliant on foreign trade, just like the cotton industry was. As we've seen with the supply chain situation where there's a slowdown in trying to get a product out of the market, it had a detrimental effect on almonds. At the same time, it's also had a detrimental effect on cotton. And that crushed consumption, that destroyed demand. So for the almond industry, you know, at a time when we thought maybe that we had a market that could support 2.8 billion pound crop, maybe we can't support that anymore in this new reality coming after the pandemic. So, you know, those dynamics, those global situations with regards to the underlying economy that both crops have, there's a lot of similarities.
Yeah. And maybe talk more about that. You know, these last few years have been such a challenge in so many ways. I mean, you just alluded to kind of the supply chain issues. And do you see that as more of a temporary issue as a result of COVID, or is this a new paradigm? Does it kind of sound like you mentioned?
Yeah, I think with regard to the supply chain issue, it sounds like we're pretty close to getting a union contract at the ports. The volume of disruption that's taken place at the port has gone away as general overall consumption has gone down because of the pressures of inflation. So that seems to be remedying itself. But, you know, it's interesting because of the situation with what's taken place with inflation and what's going on overseas, you question whether if someone has the ability to put a protein on the table like a meat versus what could be perceived as a somewhat of a luxury item like an almond, the meat protein is going to win. And so in that, there probably has been some destruction that has been done on the consumption side that we would have seen prior to the pandemic. Now, what that number is, I don't know. And will it come back to those levels? Yes. If things improve globally, but you know, the short term of what we're hearing with the potential of dipping into a recession, you know, a recession here means that globally, you know, it's going to be worse for a lot of people in a lot of third world countries that we're relying on to ship almonds to.
Right. And with you having been in your role here for 18 years, you've seen a recession before. What does that mean for almond growers and handlers usually?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. You know, I could speak from a hauler-sheller standpoint that one thing that we see is there's usually somewhat of a tipping point for us where, you know, we've enjoyed extremely strong prices for hulls and shells, which we derive 90% of our revenue from. We don't derive them from the kernels. the growers retain the ownership of the kernels. But usually there's a tipping point where one of the major sectors, and in this case, the dairy industry, will have a level of difficulty in their financial structure. Dairy products are being produced at a price that is below the cost of production. And that's been going on for about 4 months now. And so this is what happened last time. And typically, dairy is usually the precursor that causes a greater malaise in the other sectors, the other commodity markets. So we're wary of that. We're still enjoying very good pricing in the hulls, but those that buy them, you know, are very sensitive to what they can pay in four hulls and shells in a market that they're below the cost of production.
Again, this was just a portion of the Almond Journey podcast with CCAGA's Michael Kelly. You can listen to the entire podcast and other episodes by searching Almond Journey wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks, Brian, and stay tuned as we'll have more of the day's agriculture news and farm features here on the AgNet News Hour. Don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search our name of AgNet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's AgNet West. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination, our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. It's June Dairy Month, and I've got 5 benefits of modern dairy practices. Dairy is an important part of the diets of millions of Americans. The average person consumes about 276 pounds of dairy in a year. However, despite its positive impact, a significant portion of the population often misunderstands dairy. The Association of Equipment Manufacturers Dairy Leadership Group put together the top 5 benefits of modern dairy. The first is the U.S. dairy industry produces more milk than in 1944 with 16 million fewer cows. The dairy industry accounts for 3.5% of total U.S. GDP. By way of comparison, the entire auto industry accounts for 3%. Dairy is also more environmentally friendly, having reduced its GHG footprint by 17% and water usage by 10% in the last 15 years. 97% of the 34,000 dairy farms are family-owned and operated. Dairy is also an excellent source of 18 of the 22 essential nutrients needed for a healthy life. USDA's efforts to address diversity and equity. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack notes the recently announced NextGen program is among the latest efforts to expand diversity and create equity within the Agriculture Department.
This is an effort that complements the work that we're doing through the Equity Commission. They've made over 30 recommendations, many of which are in the process of being implemented, to create greater equity and diversity within the department. We have established equity plans for every single mission area. We have an accountability process. We are, for the first time ever, we have a chief diversity and inclusion officer, an executive director who is overseeing the operation and making sure that we're holding folks accountable. We're providing resources to expand significantly opportunities for farmers who are finding it a bit difficult in this economic time. They are distressed, and we're providing resources to get them to a place of greater security and comfort. We will in the near future be announcing our efforts to provide financial assistance to those who experienced discrimination in the past at USDA. So there is a tremendous amount of activity that's taking place within the department.
And rounding out today's show with more on that topic of investing in the future leaders of U.S. agriculture, USDA announced a $262.5 million investment in higher education institutions to help build that next generation of agricultural professionals across the nation. Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says this investment is all about building the future of U.S. agriculture.
If you think about the Department of Agriculture, I really think the department is the department of the future. Virtually everything we do has an impact on the future. To the extent that we have farmers who are provided credit, who in turn are then able to put seeds in the ground with the understanding that there will be a future harvest, we empower them. We empower rural communities. When you think about our food safety initiative, there is no future if our food is not safe for us to consume.
The grants to higher education institutions are run through the National Institute of Food and Agriculture's From Learning to Leading, Cultivating the Next Generation of Diverse Food and Agricultural Professionals program. He says each generation of agricultural professionals faces new challenges as they work to feed a growing population.
From learning to leading, the expectation is that we're going to invite young people to have experiences, training, and education with the hope and the belief that they will find an opportunity in agriculture, in agribusiness at USDA, and that over the course of time, as they take their life experiences and their learning experiences and combine them, they eventually will become the leaders of this department and of agriculture across the United States.
Again, that was Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.